And with DeviantArt, as time went on, there's so much stuff getting uploaded, right? We're at, 50, 60 million users, 400 million pieces of art. It becomes untenable to try to sort through it all and find the gems.
Hi, welcome to the Founders with Pet podcast, where I interview amazing entrepreneurs from diverse backgrounds about their journeys, successes, failures, and lessons along the way. Well, today I have a very special guest. He is one of the co-founders of an online art community that, I grew up in on during the early dot-com days, which is DeviantArt, if you've never heard of it. It's an online art community that's got a lot of art, videography, photography from artists all over the world. It was later acquired by Wix, an Israeli web services web hosting company. But Matthew Stevens over here today is one of the co-founders. So welcome to the show.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's go way back. How did this idea even start? Where were you? I think you were in college, I believe. So yeah, let's go way back.
Yeah, I was actually in high school. So
holy crap.
I was so before Napster, downloading music on the internet was kind of all over the place. There were a lot of websites, both illegal and legal, where you could download MP3s just straight from the website. I was involved in the legal side of that scene, and I was working with a couple of other guys, just helping them with their existing sites. The company that they were running was called Dimension Music or dmusic.com. And it was a early predecessor to mp3.com, where artists could go and upload music for their fans and their fans could go and download it and interact with the band. And it was really fun. I was always on the design side of things. So I got my start when I was probably 15 or 16 learning Photoshop, via online tutorials, like so many other people. I created a website called Wasted Youth, which just very angsty 16-year-old website. But I was obsessed with learning how to design, and I figured I would create tutorials for others as I learned this trade. And yeah, and so I was heavy in IRC, like the first, like, well, I guess they still exist, but like internet relay chat, like these huge chat rooms. And I was in the process of building a community where designers could upload the artwork that they were creating with my tutorials. It was essentially a forum, but it was a little bit more in depth than that. At the same time, I was creating a lot of Winamp skins and was heavily involved in that skinning community, which was had a big overlap with the MP3 community. And two of these guys that I was friends with were creating a similar site, but just for skin. They saw that there was a real lack of communities around the skins and wanted just kind of like a repository for all of these. And when we really started diving into it a little bit, I was like, wow, there's a huge amount of overlap between the functionality of what you're building and what I'm building. Why don't we combine these ideas and really just open it up to every type of art? Because the same features work regardless if it's, a painting or a digital art or a skin or literature or poetry, like anything really could theoretically be what we would call a deviation, right? That's anything uploaded to the site. And they were on board. And so it was three of us that started it. And it was kind of an immediate, it wasn't super immediate, but within 6 months we knew we had something special.
And you were still in high school then?
Yeah, this was the summer after my senior year. So I had just turned 18. And the site launched August 8th of 2000. I moved to Austin August like 15th to go to college here at the University of Texas. And yeah, I ran it all through college with these two other guys, and it was a lot of fun, but it was a lot of work. And my senior year, I really wanted to have a year that I lived like a normal college student. It was right as the dot-com bust was, coming down, and things were getting really hairy and DeviantArt wasn't nearly as fun as it was 4 years before. So I took a step back and got to live 1 year as a college student and continued to kind of work here and there with DeviantArt. But, you know, I really wanted to focus more on design. That was always my passion, was the craft and really getting into the nuts and bolts of design.
Yeah. What were some of the just features that you designed in the early days, and what were things that, you know, surprisingly worked or things that didn't work?
Yeah. I mean, early on it was really basic. So, you know, you could upload work, you could comment on work, you could favorite things. I think you could favorite things. There was online forums. What really was important for us early on was fostering that community, getting those core members engaged all the time, as much as you could. So what that meant for us, we commented on everything that got uploaded those first 6 months. I mean, we tried to set a good example of what a healthy community could look like. Eventually it got to the point where we just physically couldn't anymore. But at that point, right, it had already kind of taken off and people were engaging on their own. And it just kind of set the tone of what the community should look like and how supportive it can be. And, you know, this was 2000. So the toxic internet communities were a little different. Like, I don't know, DeviantArt was always a little different in that way. It's, yeah, there's plenty of bad apples, but for the most part, DeviantArt was always very supportive. It was a lot of older artists trying to help younger artists or less experienced artists learn the craft and learn the trade. And, you know, tutorials were a big part of that early iteration of DeviantArt. And it still is. One of the first things I did when we built it was to port all the tutorials. I had hundreds of tutorials at the time. I ported all of those into DeviantArt just to kind of seed that content and help people understand what it could look like.
Yeah, that sounds so much. It reminds me of the story of Reddit, you know, how the founders would create multiple accounts and engage and thank and comment on any post that kind of got and been, you know, until at some point they came back one day and they didn't have to do that anymore because the community was doing it on its own. But also sounds like the early days of YouTube where anytime somebody uploaded a video, they were so grateful. And so they would engage and comment and like and all that stuff. So, yeah.
I think it's super important. I think other things that we did, I mean, we featured artists all the time. We would write up like really nice blurbs about different artists that we felt were, you know, strong community members. And we continue to do that to this day. It's called the Deviousness Award. We feature art every day. That was another lesson I learned from previous Wasted Youth, was feature something every day. Give people a reason to come back every day. And with DeviantArt, as time went on, there's so much stuff getting uploaded, right? We're at, you know, 50, 60 million users, 400 million pieces of art. It becomes untenable to try to sort through it all and find the gems. And so we didn't want to limit who could upload. We didn't want to, you know, that there were plenty of sites that were already doing this moderation. We wanted it to be free and open, but create features like daily deviations where we could bubble up some of the stuff that we thought was really good and kind of feature those artists on a daily basis.
Yeah. So what did the staff look like? Obviously, you know, somebody had to work on the design and then build the features, but it sounded like community management also featured a big role into that.
Yeah. I mean, early on, it was a core group. There was, you know, the developer that built it. There was a CTO that kind of kept everything running. That was our biggest problem in those early days, was keeping the servers up and building new servers and dealing with the amount of traffic that we were getting. Because, I mean, this is before solid state drives. This is before the cloud, right? This is before anything.
You had to have servers. You had to actually have your own, right?
I mean, this guy just like sat in a colo facility building servers all day, you know, it was like his job. It was brutal. And then we had a team of volunteers. I mean, that's one of the things about building a really healthy community from the ground up, is that people want to be involved. They want to help. And so those people helped in each of the kind of verticals within DeviantArt, right? There's you know, there's a writing, there's a photography section, there's a, you know, there's these different sections that needed their own kind of, not necessarily moderators, but just, you know, people to help. And because there are like policy violations, there are things that need to be taken care of within the community. And at that point, we just couldn't afford to hire people. We had to rely on the community to kind of police itself.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even Reddit, those communities, and having the notion of moderators is so important. What about like copyright violations and people, bad agents using this as essentially hosting of, you know, illegal material and copyrighted material?
Yeah. I mean, that is always a challenge, still to this day is a challenge. I will say, like, from a technological standpoint, we're constantly building tools to make that easier, to bubble up things that we think might be violations earlier, developing algorithms that help identify those. And then, yeah, building teams of policy violations teams, all these people that kind of help enforce the rules. And then defining the rules is always hard, right? Like, how do you define pornography? How do you define all of these different super gray areas? I will say early on, we had a really rough rule of, if you could envision this being in a museum somewhere, then we'll allow it. Mm-hmm. Intentionally vague, intentionally open for interpretation, but it helped us kind of draw a line somewhere.
Yeah. So it sounded like the early community people were drawn perhaps for some of your tutorials and content. You seeded that, but also, like, you know, people went there for Winamp skins. For people who don't know Winamp, I mean, Matthew and I come from a time when OSs didn't come with MP3 players by default, and Winamp was a pretty awesome MP3 player. And they had this notion of skins that you could make it look like whatever. And there were some cool, like, skins that made it look like stereos with equalizers and all that. So cool.
It really was awesome. Like, I really do miss a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
Just being able to customize everything on your desktop and have a totally unique experience logging into your computer for the first time. Like,
what slogan? Do you remember it? It's pretty awesome.
I loved it. I think they're resurrecting it, actually.
Yeah. Oh, is it?
I saw something about how they're trying to bring it back, and I hope they do. But
yeah,
it's tough with Spotify and Apple Music. Like, they're the ones that own it all now. So
right. Yeah, but, you know, Spotify always looks like Spotify. You know, that's the appeal of Winamp, right? I think there's maybe an opportunity for the OG Winamp skin creators to make them all NFTs now. Like, imagine if you could have like a really popular skin and own it. That would be interesting.
A great idea. I love that.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Seriously. So what were some of the, you know, again, so Winamp skins, your tutorials, what were other draws to the crowd, you know, kind of getting traffic?
The community itself, right? The forums were always really popular. Later on, we would introduce groups. And so the challenge that we faced as the site grew was it started to lose a little bit of that communal feel when there's a million people, right? So you think about how Reddit does it with subreddits. We were trying to create groups around shared interests. So Photoshop lovers was a group, right? Like, there's like different types of groups within the community. Those took off pretty much immediately. We did a lot of interviews. We did a lot of premium content. So early on, you know, revenue streams were really advertising and these premium memberships. And so we were constantly hunting for content that we could provide to these premium members that was exclusive. So, like, skins, for instance, that were only exclusive to those premium members. We had a zine that we published, you know, every so often with some featured artwork and interviews and things like that. Yeah, I mean, there wasn't a whole lot. We even had a little chat box on the side of the website, which is crazy to think of now, of just like a being able to go into a chat room with 10,000 people now. But yeah, we had fonts, we had a lot of resources, stock photos, textures, a lot of things that artists needed to create the art.
Yeah, I remember downloading Photoshop brushes, fonts, like you said, and textures back during the Photoshop day. So all the above.
Wallpapers was always a really big one.
Oh my God. Yes. That's so right.
Yeah. So
When did you guys start thinking about the monetization?
I mean, we knew it was going to be an issue from the get-go, just because we knew that what we were hosting was going to be substantial in file size. We knew our bandwidth costs were going to be substantial. And so we were thinking about it from the very beginning. We were lucky to be under the umbrella of Dimension Music when we started. So we weren't immediately strapped. We had a little bit of a bankroll to kind of get us off the ground, but we knew that we had to think about it from the very beginning. So we weren't focused on trying to monetize the members of our community. It was really, how can we build features and tools that people actually want and would use? So when, you know, we built these premium memberships, we added the ability to gift them to people, which became a very popular way to just show appreciation for another member of the community. Reddit Gold is kind of the same idea. Ads, you know, ads have always been like the bread and butter, but that's unreliable. And so really trying to diversify that. You know, one of the last big projects that I built there was the physical print aspect. So allowing artists to sell physical representations of their work, get it and give DeviantArt a cut as well, and just kind of streamline that whole process. So things like that, things that it doesn't feel like you're taking advantage of the community.
Right. Yeah. I remember buying, you know, a print of an artist I admired. Yeah. Did that strategy work?
It did. All of these features kind of worked in different capacities. I think the prints one was a big one. You know, it poses challenges that are unique to that world. But I think that we ended up with a really quality product at the end of the day. We went through a lot of vendors to kind of facilitate those prints. But it was funny because I was still in college. I was probably 19 or 20 when I was trying to figure out which of these vendors to use. And I probably had 300 of these prints, and they're all the same because I needed to compare like apples to apples. So I had like 300 versions of this one painting done by this guy, Aaron Jasinski, who's fantastic. Wow. It is funny. It was like ridiculous.
And, you know, you've gradually stepped away. Would you want to talk about that? And then also, like, how did it start to get, you know, what was it was part of the music group, but, you know, like, talk to us about kind of like the Wix deal. I'm sure there were maybe other suitors.
Yeah. So during the dot-com bust, our primary investor was Michael Ovitz, who's a big Hollywood investor. And his lawyers basically told him, you know, that there's a lot of potential copyright lawsuits on DeviantArt. They were worried about our user agreements and the you know, all the agreements that artists were creating. And it posed a real problem for DeviantArt at the time. It was a rough period in general for the tech community. And so, yeah, I mean, DeviantArt almost didn't make it through that. Angelo, who's the current CEO, really did an amazing job of like pulling DeviantArt through that period. And like, for instance, Dimension Music, I think went under at that point too. So like everything around DeviantArt seemed to dissolve about the same time. And so it's amazing that DeviantArt was able to pull through. And then, you know, I wasn't as close to the Wix acquisition, but I think it totally made sense. I think they immediately got access to all of these fantastic designers, a community of people that could build themes for their website builder. And, you know, it seemed like a good marriage. And DeviantArt needed resources. So DeviantArt went through a rebrand around a couple of years before that acquisition, and needed resources to really roll out this massive rebrand, and Wix was able to provide that. So it worked out really well.
Now it's, you know, the design looks very different and modern, kind of looking back on the design throughout the years, but it's great to see that it's kind of made it through, because not a lot of the, I would say, first dot-com generation era startups made it through.
Yeah, I know. And DeviantArt more or less looked the same for a long period of time. And so it was great to really see it modernized, and just feels like it's part of the, you know, modern web now.
Yeah. So tell us about your journey afterwards. What happened after DeviantArt, and where are you now?
Yeah. So, you know, in high school, before DeviantArt, I was working at design agencies. Like I said, design is my passion. And I was designing throughout college while I was running DeviantArt, working with other agencies as well. When I graduated, it was, like I said, it was a tough time. This was 04. Design jobs were hard to find. Any tech jobs were hard to find in 04. I think my title was webmaster of the UT Law School for a year and just kind of ran all of their stuff. And then I really wanted to get into the startup scene. I love startups. And so, yeah, I bounced around different startups here and kind of led the design efforts at these startups. I managed design teams at a couple of agencies, built a lot of teams. And let's see, I think 2016 was really, so, well, I guess 2008, I started freelancing. I kind of left the full-time role and really wanted to just kind of, you know, work from home and manage a couple of clients. And I'm a very big believer in work to live, not live to work. You know, I love designing, but I don't want to get burned out. I feel like DeviantArt taught me at a young age what burnout can look like and how it can make something that you love so terrible. And I knew that's not what I wanted. So I felt like freelance was kind of gave me the freedom and control that I really wanted. 2016, there's a lot going on in my personal life, but I really needed just a little bit of stability. And so one of the companies that I had worked at was with a friend of mine, and he was like, "Hey, I've got this startup. They're looking for a head of design. They would love to talk to you." And I always told him, "No, I'm not looking for full-time work." But timing worked out really well. The company was called The Zebra, thezebra.com. It's like a insurtech company. Loved the team. And so I went full-time there in 2016, serving as the VP of design. And so building out a pretty big design org full of designers, product designers, marketing, brand designers, researchers, UX writers, design ops, you know, the whole thing. And
wow, how big was the team, the design team?
It was 22 when I left. I left about 6 months into COVID, but it was pretty amazing to see design running like that at scale so quickly too. And so now what I'm doing is kind of back into this consulting world and trying to help startups lay the right foundations so that when they do get to that stage, everything is set up, they don't have to redo everything, right? So building a robust design system, building a robust, you know, brand and just design ops and all the processes, kind of get those nailed down. Really trying to elevate the UX maturity at the company and just making sure that leadership is bought in, that leadership understands how design can help them service design in a way, right? So one of the big things that really helped at the Zebra was service design for other departments. So going to HR and talking about the employee experience, mapping out what the employee experience looks like using journey maps and talking about the humans on the other side of their conversation, business development and sales, right? Talking about things from the prospect's point of view, what do they want to see and things like that. I think that really goes a long way in terms of creating advocates for design and champions for the things that you're doing across the board.
Yeah. And then you would design kind of like the experience, you know, the Zebra software experience for the employees or the BD and so on.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. 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 Whatever those deliverables and assets look like ultimately came from us as well, but it was a lot of just helping them understand what design thinking looks like, what human-centered design looks like when it's not just a digital product or a website.
Yeah. If people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Yeah, good question. My website is matthewstevens.com, Stevens with a PH, common misspelling of my name. Yeah. And so right now I call myself a fractional design leader, and it's really meant to help startups kind of have a senior design leadership role without having to pay.
Right. What? Senior design leadership costs.
It's working out really well. I'm helping teams hire their first designers. I'm helping, you know, really just set the tone for what design can look like. Yeah. So website, matthewstevens.com. I'm, yeah, LinkedIn, Twitter. Yeah. I'm active on all of that stuff as well. Dribbble. I'm Matthew Larn, L-A-R-N. That's my middle name. So that one's always easier to find.
Wait, you're on Dribbble?
I know, it's funny. I mean, you can always find me on DeviantArt too. I'm Mattio, M-A-T-T-E-O. I'm on DeviantArt. So yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, I've learned of other niche kind of art sites, right? Like there's also like ArtStation, which is pretty cool for more graphic artists and special effects and all that stuff.
It's awesome to see how it's evolved over time, and there's been a lot of these communities that have taken a lot of inspiration from DeviantArt, which I loved. You know, Flickr was a great example of, you know, they were really trying to replicate what DeviantArt was doing early on.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. I mean, it's great because it's what I wanted back then, you know, and that's really what I was trying to build was something that I really wanted. So I'm happy that there's so many more of these resources, so many more like design influencers and just like ways to learn design, you know?
For sure. Yeah. I think I wish I had all these resources available to me, you know, kind of like, well, DeviantArt was a huge resource for sure. Like I mentioned with the tool, you know, the brushes and textures and stuff. But nowadays, there's like what YouTube, Skillshare, like there's Udemy, what have you. You're so lucky. In terms of startups, like, you know, kind of what, in, I guess, anything you would, you talked about burnout, right? And any other valuable startup lessons?
That's a good question. I mean, pace yourself, understand a startup doesn't have to, like, I think a lot of people misconstrue startup work as this like breakneck speed and you're working all day and night and there's no boundaries. I think that misconception is important to point out of not every startup's like that. And if it is like that, you have control over it. That for me has been helpful, right? Like understanding when to turn Slack off, when to set meeting times and things like that. That's been helpful for me. And I try to help younger people who haven't gone through it as much of like, look, you can't sustain this. And I think COVID has really made it clear that people are getting burned out more and more. And, you know, they need help understanding how to combat that, I think.
Yeah, it seemed like that was such a norm during the first .com days. I had similar startup experiences where, you know, we were working every day, including Sundays, but it was like Monday through Saturday were like full days being like, I don't know, definitely more than 12-hour days. And then Sunday was like the 8-hour day. It was like a half day. And, you know, it was really tough times, but then, you know, it's like you heard stories of everybody's doing that. And if, you know, if you're not, then it was a bit of peer pressure back then too. But then I think now the world is, the culture is more like that. Yeah, that's toxic and not sustainable. And so I'm glad that that's kind of, for the most part, gone away.
Yeah, I think so. I definitely notice it a lot less, especially as hiring has gotten harder.
Right, exactly.
It's important to point that out.
Well, thank you so much, Matthew. Like, this was pretty awesome. It was so great to have met you, and DeviantArt still, you know, being one of the OG online art communities. Kind of like, I could totally, you know, kind of relate to your journey, and having used your resources. And it was really cool to have met you.
Thanks. It's been awesome. I appreciate you inviting me on here.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Founders with Peck. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel. If you leave us a review, I'll be sure to shout it out. And if you have any questions, you can tweet me on Twitter.